Yeah, this is the gavel. I'm going to call the meeting to order. We don't have a quorum, but I think it's important that we get started, and as the members come, they can join in, and we'll call the meeting to order at that point. Today, we're going to have an informational meeting on the governor's finance bill and the policy provisions within it, and so if we could have the department come down and help us with that, we'd really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, we're going to go through the governor's supplemental or policy bill, and we're going to go through it real quickly. We won't get into any of the financial things that will be covered in the finance bill.
Commissioner, would you, for the tape, give your name?
I'm sorry. I am Commissioner Alice Segrin for the Department of Education. So we're going to go through this very quickly for you, and then we'll move into the technical policy bill to cover that. First of all, we just want to remind you that we have done a lot in the reform area, and the governor's policy bill is going to kind of reinforce some of the things that we've been working on. We've established rigorous academic standards and increased our grad requirements. We fundamentally changed the way we pay teachers and reward achievement and provide for really practical professional development. We focused on STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, and we've also expanded our public school choice. We do know that we have challenges, and we want to come alongside of our teachers to help them become as successful as they possibly can be. We know that effective teachers and instruction will increase student achievement. So it is time, in time of our economic deficits, we must tighten our belts, of course, and curb spending, but we can't afford to stop doing our reform. So we are going to be focusing on strengthening our teacher and principal effectiveness in a number of ways. The governor's education proposals cover the Teaching Transformation Act, updating principal licensure, teacher evaluation and tenure renewal act, English language proficiency standards, minimum hours of instruction, teacher contract reporting, and EPAS data collection. The Teaching Transformation Act, why should we focus on helping our teachers? It's because we know that the most effective teachers will raise student achievement. You all are familiar with Dr. Robert Marzano and the studies that he has done on effective teaching. And he's found that a 43% positive impact on student achievement is the highest school-based factor. By comparison, class size only had an 8% positive impact. We've had data and studies from Tennessee to show that if two average 8-year-old students were given different teachers, one of them a high performer and one a low performer, the student's performance diverged more than 50% within 3 years. Dallas study found that the performance gap between students assigned three effective teachers in a row and those assigned three ineffective teachers in a row had a 49 percentile difference. So what are we wanting to talk about with the Teaching Transformation Act? We want to, first of all, align teacher preparation standards with K-12 standards. So we are proposing that every time we have a review process for our K-12 standards, then the next year following that, then the Board of Teaching then review the teaching standards or the preparation standards for our teachers so that they are aligned as they go through their programs. We want to strengthen teacher preparation in elementary mathematics and require teaching candidates to pass a math content exam. And the reason we're doing this, remember we had the discussion about the importance of reading a few years ago. We want to also, and the Board of Teaching is going to bring in experts to look at the best instructional practices around math, because we know that both of those, especially in the elementary area, will be very important as we build the building blocks towards our new academic standards, particularly in math and science. So we're going to focus on math next, or the Board of Teaching is. We also want to require online pedagogy and a completion of at least one online course for all teacher licensure candidates. We know that online teaching is going to become more and more a part of our system, and the Board of Teaching wants to not only expose teachers, and I think most teacher candidates will be doing some online work already. I think that that's going to be a pretty much of a given. But I think the Board of Teaching is also interested in the discussion about maybe even preparing or starting to think about and exploring a license for online teaching so that you really have quality online teaching when when that does happen. So that's going to be another whole area that I think will be very important as we look to the future. We also want to monitor the effectiveness of teacher and administrator programs using multiple measures, student performance data that's linked to the teachers and administrators who have graduated from their institutions, teacher and administrator prep programs. This is something that we think will be very helpful if we can develop some measures of success for those provisional teachers, those that are in that probationary status, and feeding that information back to the preparation programs so that they know how well their teacher candidates did once they got out into the field. And then we also want to incorporate national standards for effective school leadership into the licensing standards for principals. And there are a number of national standards that have been developed, and we want to look at the existing principal leadership standards and make sure that we have strong, effective 21st standards for those candidates. The Board of Teaching should adopt a standards alignment review process. I went through that, of course, with you. And the alignment will increase the effectiveness of Minnesota's teacher workforce because teacher candidates will have instruction to the same standards. We're asking for an appropriation. That's not something that you cover here, but you can see what the rulemaking costs would be. Then we're also proposing that teacher candidates should be required to pass a basic skills test before they enter a preparation program. Right now, they are required to take the test but not pass it. And if you remember, even in our open admission schools, like our technical colleges and our community colleges, a student cannot take even a general course unless they are remediated and are prepared to take a course. However, in a teacher preparation program, that is not true. You can go all the way through a four-year preparation program, you can graduate, and you can have another 3 years of provisional licensure without ever passing a basic skills test. And we don't think that that's a good signal to send to the teaching profession. It does not elevate and it does not honor the teaching profession. And in addition to that, if you look at the NCAA freshman standards to get into for eligibility, that's what you have to do to be admitted there. And we don't even have that kind of qualifications for our teachers necessarily. So we think we should send a strong signal that there should be some basic admission requirements. I covered this, so that we're recommending that students demonstrate academic qualifications and basic knowledge before entering into the preparation program. I went over this, the elementary math content. We are going to, or the Board of Teaching is going to be looking at this. The appropriation is as you see. Again, I covered this fairly quickly, the importance of online pedagogy, learning that or understanding that, and also the requirement to take at least one online course. We are going to also, as you know, we have our principal academy that is working with our existing experienced principals. We also want to look at the standards for principal leadership and update those for the 21st century. And then also we are going to be looking at both the preparation and teacher and administrative preparation programs so that they have more robust requirements that we're looking at for performance. Then the next thing that we're looking at is teacher evaluation. The governor proposes to strengthen the induction period for new teachers, provide support for all teachers' professional growth, and require teacher employment and renewal of that employment at least every 5 years based on academic achievement growth of students and other measures, and recruit, retain, and reward the most highly qualified and effective teachers. Teacher evaluation should have meaningful summative quality assurance and formative professional growth functions, and of course that's what we do when we look at our QCOM program. We have both. We don't have either or, and we think that that's very, very important. Charlotte Danielson and her work talks about good teacher evaluation systems merge these two processes or purposes and lead to improved instruction. And the proposal utilizes a model for teacher evaluation that requires a cycle of review for teachers beyond the traditional probationary period and a full formal evaluation at least once every 5 years. Now, as you know, every teacher that's a continuing licensed teacher is required to have 125 or 50 credit hours. Thank you, Lisa. 125 hours of continuing credit. What we are proposing to do is to make that a more robust process whereby you're looking at a portfolio of work that a teacher accumulates over a five-year period. So a sample of students' work, examples of the student growth, academic achievement of the students in their classes, and other pedagogical and work that would be important for tenure renewal. Also, we want to re-look at our English language proficiency standards. They have not been revised since 2003. The field is asking for a standards review and a revision of those English language standards. At the federal level, too, we have had feedback that our standards need to be redone, and so we're going to be having a review of those proficiency standards. This will be an important first step in addressing existing challenges and improving the way ELL instruction is delivered. And then also the rulemaking costs will be paid for with existing Title III funds. We'll be able to do that with those funds. Then also we are revising the instructional hours, are the instructional time that students have right now, or I think the way the law reads now, it talks about days. We are wanting to set a minimum amount of hours of instruction that allows for more flexibility for districts to plan their school calendar, and so the hours are articulated there for kindergarten, grades 1 through 6 and 7 through 12. And then we're also going to reestablish a penalty for districts who do not meet those instructional hours. Then also there's been a lot of question about contracts and settlements, and so the governor, teachers' contract settlements, so the governor is recommending that school districts report the negotiated contract settlements to the Department of Education so that that information can be publicly accessible to everyone who is interested in that, and that information would include salary, benefit, and retirement costs and total package percentages for a contract. And then finally, our EPAS data collection system. That is an adjunct system to our ACT program. It is run by the ACT folks. It is it's an 8th and 10th grade, what I call pretest, and also a survey of how students are doing in conjunction with the possibility of them taking an ACT test. The 8th and the 10th grade, plan and explore, help students know where they're at academically, and also help them with remediation possibilities, or also with acceleration, and kind of give them a sense of what abilities they have as they're preparing for high school. We have some unexpended money in that program. We pay for every 8th grade and 10th grade plan and explore test for any district that wants it. It's not mandatory, but we pay for everyone that wants it, or the exams for those students. And we have some unexpended money. And one of the things that we are excited about now is we have had enough students starting in 8th grade and then have taken the 10th grade and then have taken the ACT. So what we want to do is now look at setting up a longitudinal study that can go forward and then really see how those students do as they first take the 8th grade test. And there's also a survey with that, so that's also looking at what kinds of courses they choose, what kinds of action is taken after the result of those 8th and 10th grade tests. So we're going to recapture some of that money that was unexpended and develop that longitudinal system that will help us do that. Because that money, unexpended money, generally goes back to the general fund, that's why we have a cost. We have to show a cost to that. We can't just count that as free money, unfortunately. So that's what we are proposing to do with that. And that is basically all of the policy things that are in the governor's bill. And if you would like, we can move on to the technical bill, or I can take questions for the governor's on the governor's bill.
Thank you, Commissioner. We are at quorum, so I'm going to officially call us to order. Commissioner, I do have several quick questions. I just want to cycle through and then open it up for questions for committee members, and then we'll move on to the technical bill. And so let me just sort of go through quickly in chronological order of the bill. So one question, my first question having to do with the E-Pass funds that have not been, or that are still sitting there is the analysis that you want to be able to do, which I think is a good idea. Can you tell us, are we doing any of that right now, or is this a new effort to be able to do that? And what do you, and again, what do you hope to be able to accomplish with that kind of analysis?
Mr. Chair and members, we do have not been doing that analysis yet because we didn't have enough students taking that took the 8th and the 10th and now the ACT. So now this is when we met with the ACT folks just recently when we received our good news about, you know, being number one again. They also talked about our E-Pass work, and they said this would be a really prime time now that you'll be able to start looking longitudinally at how the kids that started in 8th grade and 10th and then took the ACT, how those students did, to give you feedback into those schools to say, all right, these kids took this. This is how they did. Where there are there signs or things, success factors that you did with these students that allowed them to then be really successful with their ACT? What were the interventions potentially? Because what we're doing is working with our school counselors. We've had a number of training sessions with counselors in how to use the plan and explore with their students that take it. So they're starting to, we're starting to identify more and more students that have the ability to take higher level courses, but sometimes are not encouraged to do that. We are catching kids early that are potentially struggling with in some coursework and able to help remediate them before they get too off track. So we want to, you know, kind of look at all of that data, and that will be helpful information then for our school districts to use. So it will not only be statewide level data, but it will also be for the school districts to be able to use for their students and how well they did.
Commissioner, later next week we'll be hearing from the CCRPI assessment work group, and I suspect that part of that discussion will also involve a thinking about how to use data to ensure that what we're practicing, what we're doing in K-12 is increasingly aligning us with college and career readiness standards. Commissioner, on section 2 of page 10, we've got the language, and so this is a shift. We're entrance into board-approved teacher preparation programs where we'd be calling for passing the skills examination. I just want to note it for members that is an important shift. I'm actually empathetic to that, and I think this reflects some of the perspectives that were shared last year from a number of folks when we had a 1 or 2 day session on teacher preparation and teacher quality issues, including people from the Bush Foundation. Can you tell me, and if not, we can do this, we can get it later, as empathetic as I may be to this, you know, do we have a body of research that points to the efficacy of that kind of approach?
Mr. Chair and members, there is research. I quoted Dr. Marzano and his work that he has done on effective and ineffective teachers. What we are trying to say here is right now we have a system that does not require a potential candidate to pass a basic skills test before they can begin taking their regular courses for teacher preparation. They are allowed to complete, that doesn't mean pass the test, mm-hmm. And then go ahead into their training programs. And ironically, even though we have open admission institutions like technical schools and community colleges, even though they're open admission, if you don't have a basic level of math knowledge to pass a general course because you haven't met, you know, an ACCUPLACER standard or whatever, You cannot even start your courses until you've been remediated. We do not have that in the teacher preparation requirements. And I think it's very, very important. It's not to say that you can't be one if you haven't passed that test. It just means that you need to have your remediation. You need to be prepared so that you can go forward and be more successful as a teacher candidate. In fact, I was at a Board of Teaching meeting here probably 3 months ago, and a number of the teachers that serve on the Board of Teaching did not realize that that was the case. They thought that you had to pass this basic skills test before getting in. They did not realize that you could go all the way through a preparation program, still not pass your basic skills test, and still have a provisional license for 3 more years before, you know, you could not, you know, continue. I don't think that's very ethical to take someone's money for 4 years. And also potentially have them teaching in a classroom when they still don't have their basic understanding down, because we are going to be requiring teachers also to have much more rigor that they have to teach, and so we have to have strong candidates. But it does not mean that we cannot remediate and support those teachers and help them become successful, but they need to get that under their belt before they can start tackling the preparation programs.
Commissioner, on the Section 6, under applicants license in other states, we mirror, so you'll see a lot of mirroring this under the different avenues, right? And here we add the successfully completed human relations preparation components. I would argue that that's one of those rigor elements that we need to increasingly pay attention to and cultivate in our teacher candidates. But I take it that the language there is sort of a safeguard in terms, yes, of Minnesota's value that may not be reflected by other quality standards in other states. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. We wanted to make sure that that was clear, that they had to successfully complete that. Now, there may not be a standardized test behind those courses, so that was a little bit harder to articulate, but we wanted to make clear that they must successfully complete those courses.
Commissioner, in Section 4, page 12, where we've got the sharing of data information, educational data, between the Board of Teaching and the Department of Education, and I think this also repeats itself in a couple of places for program approval and improvement for teacher education program. I get objectively, logically, the need to have real data that informs programs based on real experiences that are happening in a classroom. Now, obviously, we're being careful here because on line 23, we've got remains confidential. So I take it we're talking about specific teacher performance data?
Mr. Chair, this it will be developed by the Board of Teaching. We need data sharing. Of course, we're developing our longitudinal data system. We are sharing data between K-12 and higher ed. The data sharing agreements that we will have with the Board of Teaching and the Board of School Administrators will allow us then to look at the performance of those candidates once they obtain their provisional licensure. We will follow them for 3 years or so, and then feed that information back to the preparation programs and also the Board of Teaching and school administrators to see how well those candidates are doing once they have been trained. We think, and this will take some time to develop because you want to also be able to develop the kinds of multiple measures and have agreement on that to reflect back. Louisiana has been, and I'm not sure if your committee or some committee, maybe it was the Senate or the House, has had some hearings, or maybe it was through the one of the CCRPI working groups, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. But I think Louisiana had come in and talked about how they have looked at their preparation programs and then have fed that information back to them, where they have seen sometimes where a program has been weak in, let's say, math content or math pedagogical skills, feed that back to the preparation program so that they know that those candidates potentially or their program needed to be revamped. This data would not be identifiable, individual identifiable data. It would be aggregate data that would be used to look at the different programs. So as you said, for potential renewal of a preparation programs are also for just feeding back and improvement of those programs. So it could be used for both.
And Commissioner, throughout the framework here, there's reference to measuring or assessing teacher quality performance over time based on a number of measurements, including student learning. I get where student learning could be readily identified, measured by performance on standardized tests. And you've mentioned earlier the notion of multiple measures. This committee, of course, has been very interested in the use of multiple measures for a number of factors. Mechanically, however, where will the point of decision be in regards to the specifics of what those measures, those multiple measures, would be relative to this framework? Is it the intent to have that be uniformly applied across the state? Would it be local units or local districts that are determining what the multiple measures would be? Would that lie, reside within the Department of Education?
Madam or Mr. Chair, I think the intent with the Board of Teaching and the process for review of preparation programs, our review of what is happening with the teacher would be developed by the Board of Teaching, would be developed by teachers, higher education people, to look at what would be the standards and the measures that you would look at for a successful probationary teacher, someone who has just been working their first year, 3 years in a school district. What are those kinds of things that you should be evaluating for a teacher? So first of all, there's going to be quite a lot of work that will have to be done and discussion about that will be developed. And then that would be expected would be more of a framework or standardized process that you would be looking at. I would expect that there would be a great partnerships with the teacher preparation programs and school districts. The Bush Foundation probably and their work with the schools that they have selected probably are going to provide us with some really strong work with trying to do those linkages and follow teachers, because they're also going to be having partnerships with the school districts and the preparation programs and following those teachers into those programs. So we're going to have some really rich information that we'll be able to use as people discuss how to build a framework. But eventually I would think that it would be a framework, an expectation of what you should be looking for as you're making those decisions. But this is for the preparation programs. This isn't for licensure of those teachers. This is for just the looking at the health of the preparation programs and how well the students are doing and feeding that back.
However, Commissioner, I think it also is for the post 5-year tenure issue as well. Is that correct?
Well, that would be a different issue. That would be the evaluation of your tenured teachers, I think, would take some different standards and different evaluation processes that you would want to look at after you've met your first initial 3-year provisional process. So we've got, several things, kind of several steps that are going to be worked on. As you know, I'll talk about Race to the Top for a little bit. We are proposing to bring together people to look at an evaluation rubric for teachers that are the professional teacher for the future, just because we have so many districts that are interested in QComp, but as they're rural, don't have as much depth of staff to allow somebody to go off and do that kind of work independently. So we are going to be bringing people together to talk about and look at what that would look like. And that's going to be very exciting work. We have a lot of national expertise. We have Charlotte Danielson, who has come in here many times, and her work does describe the domains of effective practice for teachers. That is one rubric that is being used a lot. But we also have some other models that have been developed. So I think this is going to be a really rich discussion. We also will have, the discussion about the teacher preparation programs. The Board of Teaching, too, is working with the AACT, or, no, okay, help me, guys.
AACTE.
Thank you, AACTE. I was not sure if I should put the E on the end of it. But they are looking at a program, a teacher performance assessment, that would be an assessment that as you leave your preparation program, what are the criteria that you should be looking at that would indicate that a teacher has the ability for good success as a probationary or provisional teacher. We're really excited about that work. Stanford is working in conjunction with the AACTE, and we are one of the states that's been selected, and we're working with the higher ed institutions on that. So we want some robust signals and criteria, and that will fit in again with looking at how preparation programs are doing. That's going to be another signal and indicator. We can follow those candidates then into the profession and even compare those colleges that use that process and those that maybe have a more simple process to see how effective that is.
So we're creating a framework to be able to accomplish several things, the quality and the nature of teacher preparation programs, our ability to understand effective practices in the classroom, be able to do some assessments, including eventually be able to dovetail with this proposed new direction relative to tenure beyond the 5 years. Members, we do have MACDE here in the audience, and a little bit later I'll call them forward so that they can say hello. Some of this, some of these issues obviously involve their institutions. I will ask one more question, members, and then I'll stop hogging the mic. And Commissioner, that takes me to page 27, which is section 17 of Article 2, and that's the ELL standards review. Work that that you want to be able to do, and which I welcome. My quick question on that is: this is focus for instruction. One of the things that I'm additionally concerned about in terms of updating and sort of modernizing our approach with EOL students has to do with assessments. Is it the intent of this language to also then look at the assessment frameworks that we use relative to these students?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to let Dirk Mattson, our assessment person, come up here and kind of give you what's happening with our assessment in relationship with this.
Commissioner, that's appropriate. We can't have a hearing without Dr. Mattson testifying. Dr. Mattson, good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Dirk Mattson, Director of Research and Assessment for the Department. Thank you for the warm welcome. Very briefly, you are correct. Any time that standards change significantly, and under what's proposed here, they would change significantly, we're required to redesign the assessment. And that doesn't mean we necessarily build it. One of the conversations that's going on right now, both internally and externally, is that they're looking to a national set of standards that have been adopted by TESOL. Thank you. And there are a number of tests, because those are, it's almost like the national standards conversation that's going on. EOL has already had that conversation. There is a set of national standards. And so there are a number of tests that are already aligned to that, and that may ease our ability to move more quickly than necessarily building from scratch, which is to some degree what our current test is aligned to Minnesota's EOL standards. It would be a broader, more national look and assessment as well.
And Dr. Mattson, I've had the privilege of interacting with folks across the nation, and particularly our Latino community, on ELL assessment issues, and this is an area of big concern across the nation. And what I hear from some researchers is that we're still not quite yet at the place, so perhaps you can tell me whether I'm hearing this right or wrong, we're still not quite at the place where these tests, and I'm not a researcher, so I'm sure I'm going to mess up the terminology here, but where there haven't been sort of large-scale validity normed activities relative to these tests. And so in my layperson's mind, I'm thinking, you know, Carlos, this is more than just, you know, taking a test that's been normed for a population that's not an EOL population and translating it into, you know, certain practices, that it requires something deeper here. Can you maybe just say something quickly about that and what you would be looking at, assuming you're able to move forward with this relative to that issue?
Yes, Mr. Chair. There's two parts here. So one is on the academic content standards, our reading and math standards, that having ELLs of a very broad disparity of their proficiency in academic English, certainly there's ongoing conversation about how well are we measuring those standards. Obviously, if you're giving a reading test to that is grade level proficient to a student who's new to the country, they're not going to be able to engage in that. That's one piece. And so I think there are ongoing conversations about how do we best tap, measure that skill and knowledge that a student has on the academic content standards. On the language proficiency standards, which is what this is about, I would say it's still a newer vein of educational measurement, but I think it's stabilizing somewhat, and I believe the assessments that I've seen out there are finding themselves to be able to provide appropriate validity. So, for example, there is a consortium of states, roughly about I think 15 to 20 states, that's involved in a particular consortium, and they have been doing this for a number of years with out of the University of Wisconsin, a consortium that measures that ELL, and they're finding they're really looked at across the nation as one of the expert measurements, and they're finding the validity is confirming itself, I guess. So they're not finding a divergent in that case. Okay. Certainly, there are some companies that want to get started with the same assessment. They're much newer, in a couple three years older, and they don't have as much longitudinal information as University of Wisconsin, for example.
Dr. Madsen, if at some future date you can help me connect with that reference, I'd appreciate it. Members, as promised, I'll stop hogging the mic and turn over to other members of the committee. Representative Benson, followed by Representative Bloom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioner. Looking at your outline, there are many things here that I would certainly agree with. The emphasis I would like to visit with you a little bit about has to do with the quality of the professionals, or in what ways the department has developed means to attract and retain quality teachers. I notice, for example, one area which has to do with enhancing entry requirements, kind of the gatekeeping aspect of the proposal here. But I find it interesting, for example, the quotes from the Tennessee study and a Dallas study that indicates that having competent teachers in front of the classroom does, in fact, make a difference. And you know, when I think about that, I wonder whether there are studies being carried similarly in, for example, the legal profession or the medical profession, that we would need to have studies to validate something that seems to be a self-evident fact. And I only bring that up because I think it does indicate the level at which the teaching profession is seen by society in relationship to these other professions. And I just want to make a comment about that. I noticed Dr. Marzano's study indicating class size has an 8% positive impact. And when we think about the profession itself and being able to attract people, does the department consider the impact on the work environment for a professional who would want to be in front of the classroom with constantly oversized classes, and the professional frustration that would grow as they see more and more students falling through the cracks because the teacher has 150 students a day? And I just think of the legal profession. If they had to competently deal with 150 clients a day, or a doctor or a nurse. So the comment I see is kind of a negative in saying, well, you know, the client size doesn't really matter in relationship to attracting and retaining teachers. I think it does. Looking at the teacher entry requirements, which I do think is a positive thing. I do think if there are more gates to entry into a profession, it tends to raise the public's view of the profession and people who might want to go into it. But I am kind of disturbed by the fact that the department seems reticent to push the issue a little bit further. For example, we were being compared to the NCAA freshman requirements. And when I think of the University of Minnesota basketball team and some of the problems there, or generally throughout the nation, the abysmally low graduation rates that universities and colleges, in my opinion, are exploiting these young people. They're not getting into, you know, the MBA or professional sports, and many of them never graduate. I feel personally a little offended that the department is suggesting a GPA of 2.5. I think that is ridiculous. It should be at least a 3.0, considering a great inflation at university levels these days.
As in my alternative teacher licensure bill.
Mr. Chair.
And I do have another question, if I have a follow-up, please.
If you could make it a quicker question.
It will be real quick.
It would be wonderful. Commissioner.
Real quick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, I agree with you wholeheartedly. The examples that we were given are just showing that there are higher criteria for, and which I agree all with your comments about athletes, than what we're requiring now, because we don't even require even that of teachers. And I'm wholeheartedly supportive of your position that we need to send a message to our society that teachers are highly respected, and we should have higher processes, but we started with at least having some basic requirements for people to get into the profession. And this was one of the things that we decided to do. But these were examples that we don't even have those criteria
right
in place.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your indulgence. Just a quick one. A comment and then just a question. I would really love to see the department come back with more concrete proposals for enhancing the profession of teaching in the sense of making it attractive. All these other reforms are peripheral to dealing with how do we attract and retain top quality people. If you look at Finland, you look at Japan, you look at Korea, these other countries that are beating us in this area, they all highly regard teaching. They highly compensate it. All these other factors go into it. I know part of this is cultural. But I do have one question. On the tenure issue with teachers, which I'm not debating that one way or another, but do you have a similar proposal for the administrative cadres?
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, yes, we would be doing the same thing for the principals, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Commissioner, on that issue, how will that impact charter schools? Because part of the framework, as I read it, is that that evaluation would be conducted by licensed administrators. Mm-hmm. And so we've got the issue of not licensed principals as principals of charter schools. So is that sort of a kind of a gray area for us to figure out? I assume that we want to be able to drive the same kind of quality assessments and expectations of principals of charter schools.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, that is a gray area for us because charters are not required to have a licensed administrator running their school. So that would be a different situation. But we certainly, they're a public school, and we want to and expect the highest quality from those institutions also. So that's something that probably we will need to
Commissioner, I think
discuss.
We should. I think it's critically important. Representative Liu, followed by Representative Greiley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Commissioner, for your excellent testimony. I guess kind of following on Representative Benson's questions and the proposal you have, I think clearly trying to get our best and brightest into teaching is critical, but also equally critical, which you pointed out in this proposal, is the mentoring of those new teachers. I'm concerned. We have a lot of people, obviously, that enter teaching and then leave shortly thereafter, I think frustrated, and I think in part because we throw them into the deep end of the pool with very little in terms of a life ring and expect them to kind of just swim their way through. Can you talk a little bit more in detail about what you're envisioning with regards to strengthening that mentorship? And I'm wondering if, are the districts going to be given more kind of best practices in crafting new teacher mentorship programs? Have you done anything in terms of maybe even focus groups and that with new teachers about what you really need? And then the trained mentors, which are clearly key in this, how are those people trained? And are districts going to be doing some kind of cross-pollination of best practices to help with that?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bloom, on page 17, as you're probably looking at it, the requirement for an induction process for the new teacher. We feel that that's very important. And a few years ago, and Representative Peterson probably is very fully aware of this, Education Minnesota, the Department of Education, MinSCU, and I think the university were involved in creating a program of induction. And it's a very specific framework of best practice and what induction and mentoring should look like. And we would certainly like to have that framework used. Probably 3 or 4, maybe 5 years ago now, it's all the years start to flow together too fast. We had proposed about $3 million to do a statewide mentoring program. We had received some federal money and had implemented it across the state in certain school districts that wanted to participate, and it was so successful. The results were really wonderful, and we wanted to scale that up. We did not get the funding, but we are proposing that we still try to do this using the professional development set-aside monies that districts have to really, you know, make a strong statement. And it gets to Representative Benson's statement that what are some concrete things we should do to improve the workplace? Number one for probationary teachers is to provide a really strong induction model, not something that where, you know, experienced teachers got 10 teachers that they're trying to track and they might see them once during the year. But, you know, really a strong framework of what induction should look like. So that's what we are proposing here, that school districts do that. And we will certainly, we have a wonderful model already developed that we can train on and that we can work on together with our institutions.
One quick follow-up question. And one of the things I've often pondered is if there is an appropriate place for some parent feedback as part of this process. And again, I speak just as a parent with kids in the public schools and someone who's been active as a parent volunteer. And I know it gets sensitive when you're really talking also about workplace issues, but I think, you know, when you've got kids in school, one of the key issues of whether or not you feel like your child is successful or the teacher at that classroom that your child is in is successful is key issues of communication and types of communication and that. And I'm not sure that there's a component within that sort of mentorship of incorporating that kind of suggestion. So I don't know if anything's been looked at with regards to some kind of way to get some parent feedback into those mentorship programs, but I would just throw that out for consideration.
Commissioner, the committee has its most creative minds on hats on this morning.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Loon, actually part of the induction process, and actually I think MACT would also corroborate this, there is more and more emphasis in training of teachers and in the induction process too of really basically helping teacher candidates and probationary provisional licensed teachers to understand that the communication with parents is really key to being successful with the students in their classroom, and also being willing to take that feedback from parents. The child and the parent is the customer, and that is something that is very, very important for a teacher to understand early on, and that is part of the induction process that has been developed. But again, I think Mac would also talk about how there's a lot of training now that's going on with, you know, just really getting teachers to understand how important it is you know, work with parents. We have a lot of parents that actually contact, I mean, a lot of teachers that actually contact parents weekly and go really almost above and beyond sometimes, I think, what is required of them because they are so concerned about making sure that their children are successful. Parents are key.
I'm sorry. Members, I still do want to get to House File 3163. I've decided that we would spend more time on this bill because House File 3163 will form as the basis for our actions next week as we shape up a policy article that we will be forwarding, hopefully, to Commissioner Greiling's committee. And so we'll get a, you know, in other words, sort of a second crack at looking at House File 3163. But I do want to get through it today. And so, Commissioner, sort of a heads up that when we do that, we'll be moving at lightning speed on 3163. And I know that there's a number of folks that wanted to, that are part of your presentation. So let me propose that we do this for about another 10 minutes. We have several members still with questions, including Representative Greiling. And Representative Greiling, at this point, if you would be so kind to move the minutes of March 3rd, and then we'll get to your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the minutes of March 3rd.
Thank you, Representative Greiling. Moves the minutes, adoption of the minutes of March 3rd. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. We have Representative Greiling, Representative Briner, Representative Demmer, Representative Peterson, and let's see if we can all do that in 10 minutes. Representative
Thank Greiling. You, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Segrin, you mentioned that this was going to engender rich discussion, and I am certain that it will because, members, this bill ends tenure. Did you know that? On page 20, it seems to me it ends tenure. And that's going to take a lot of discussion. And, Commissioner, I'm wondering, when we had Race to the Top, you said that we wouldn't need any statutory changes and that employment would not be affected. So this bill is then unrelated to the Race to the Top application?
Mr. Chair?
Commissioner.
Yes.
So, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Segrin, pardon me? Oh, you're calling on me. Thank you. Mr. Chair, Commissioner Segrin, so we don't need to pass this bill at all, none of it, in order to have districts enter into contracts for Race to the Top.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, no. But, well, Mr. Chair, I would like to correct Representative Greiling's interpretation of this proposal. Right now, teachers have to fulfill a 125-hour credit requirement before they can renew their license. So what this proposal is doing is to say, let's enrich that renewal process by looking at multiple measures, work sampling, work product, student achievement examples, pedagogical skills, looking at a more robust way of that tenure renewal. So it is not ending tenure. It is actually looking at a different way of tenure renewal than what we have right now.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, I would...
I mean, Representative Greiling.
I would urge members to look at page 20 of the bill, and Commissioner Segrin, I beg to differ, because right now, teachers... after tenure must not be discharged or demoted except for cause and after a hearing. In this bill, their tenure ends every 5 years, and they must be rehired based on all the criteria that are here, which are fine criteria, but I don't know why you took the draconian step to end tenure while having this rich discussion about having quality teachers and working with all, because I think that poisons the well, just like enhanced QComp and tying more test scores to teacher compensation and licensure does in Race to the Top. And I think it's unnecessary to poison the well when we have these discussions. They're much more fruitful without any poison in the discussion. And I'm wondering, my last question, I know you want me to be quick because I could take a half an hour too, Mr. Chair.
This is very important.
Thank you. I would like to know what happens if a school district signed the contract for a race to the top with the trust then that they get money from the federal government, but then we pass this law, which is different, you're saying. Are they going to have to forfeit their money for a race to the top, or is this just piling on and that won't matter?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, no, I don't think that they would have to forfeit their money.
Well, Mr. Chair, just last comment. I think this is very serious, and we could have a whole hearing on Article 2, Section 13, and probably would not come to any resolution anytime soon in this lifetime.
Representative Wiley, this as I walked, read through the bill this morning, I put a huge asterisk next to this section, as I suspect many of you did as well, regardless of how you're on this issue. And Commissioner, let me just suggest, as a layperson, from a layperson that's not a legal lawyer at all, that perhaps what you're intending to do in the dominant framework here can still be done without the dismissal of the current language on line 34 and 35, and I would ask you to consider that. I think you can still move forward, it seems to me, with a good quality, high-quality renewal framework, which I think would enjoy broad support here, without discharging this particular provision, safeguard, and existing law. Representative Briner, Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be a little more targeted in my comments, I hope, but because Representative Greiling has already raised the more volatile elements around the teacher tenure issue. But, Commissioner, you might have guessed my concern lies within that domain. In your slides in that regard, it says require teacher employment and renewal of that employment at least every 5 years based on academic achievement growth of students. Now, when you look within that element in more detail in the bill, that's specified with school-wide student achievement gains, and then it says locally selected standardized academic assessment student outcomes. That's pretty broad and maybe a little difficult to interpret. But my concern is this. We're in our second year of gathering growth data with a growth model that was developed over with a year's work, a lot, maybe more than a year's work, a lot of really strong research-based academic assessment expertise, psychometric background, and people at the table who really understood these issues. And when we did that, the caution of that group was, let's just gather the data. We'll look at the data, and after we've had at least 2 years of data, let's come back together, and then let's talk about whether that data tells us anything about the grade level or the individual teacher. But in the meantime, let's not make any assumptions that we can use that data to evaluate teachers. So I'm cautious, and I'm asking us to be careful as legislators who want to be research-based and data-driven. Simply because data exists doesn't mean it can be meaningfully applied. That's all I'm asking for, is that caution, and that we wait till we bring the professional experts back to the table before we assume we can make that connection.
Commissioner, you've heard the caution. I don't know if we need a long response here, but
Mr. Chair, and I certainly respect your caution and Representative Greiling's caution too, and we will take those under consideration. The intent of developing a retenure process is to really do it in a fair way and with multiple measures and with data that is reliable. And so the intent, this would not certainly happen overnight. Would be something that should be done carefully, and you would certainly have my commitment that that would be done also. And we certainly don't want to poison anybody's well either, so we will certainly take Representative Greiling's advice under deep consideration too, because we would like this to move forward, and if there are ways to do this in a positive way, that would be really exciting.
Appreciate that, Commissioner. Representative Demmer, and then Representative Peterson, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief because we can a lot of things, obviously, we can go into the weeds on these things. I was a little bit stirred, and in a good way, Representative Benson's comments, because it's about high expectations. I believe high-performing individuals is what we want, high-intellect, engaging people is what we want in the teaching profession. It's not just about the content. It's also about inspiring people, and that's what we want. And to me, those kinds of people want high expectations. They want to be expected to be the best. I can't resist responding a bit to Representative Greiling's comments also, because when we think about high expectations, should we have your concerns, Representative Greiling? If we're really concerned about high expectations and people performing at their best, are they really going to be concerned about having to show that they're still a good teacher every 5 years?
Thank you, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sometimes I wish that we would consider the medical model also as we look. You know, the licenses for doctors and attorneys, I think, are something that we should consider and look at as we deal with teacher licenses. I know, and the medical model, after 5 years, they don't look at how many people or the doctors have saved, how many have died, how many have lived. It would be a pretty poor way, I think, to judge doctors, because the doctors would take all the good patients, I think, and they in order to get their licenses removed. But the one thing the doctors do well, and one thing that I think is emerging from NCATE, which is from the college system, is the idea of residency. And doctors do a residency, and I think it's a good model for teachers. And that, instead of the student teaching or the mentoring, would be part of a residency program where the teachers would teach part-time. They would get their degree in whatever content area, and then they would go to a particular school where there would be part-time teaching and then part-time professional development and pedagogy and mentoring for the rest of the day, and it would be done with those people who are very skilled and as mentors, and the professional development schools could be placed at strategic places around the state. I think that kind of intense professional development at a residency school could provide a good basis for people really being ready to enter the classroom with the kinds of skills that they need. And that is emerging as one of the ways that we can get teachers most ready, and it certainly gets doctors ready for what they must face as their profession demands.
Members, I'll take that as a helpful comment and observation, looking at another sector to help guide some of our decisions here. At this point, I would like to ask, is Dr. Munson here? Bruce Munson, MACD? Okay. Is anyone from MACD here? Maybe just quickly come forward, say hello, and we're talking maybe a minute or two at the most. I apologize, but we do want to acknowledge and recognize the presence of MACD. Ms. Prim. Boy, third time's a charm.
That's right. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Maureen Prenn, and I'm past president of MACD. That's the Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. I'm also a faculty member at Minnesota State Mankato. And I bring you greetings. This is our MACD Day on the Hill, so some of you may see some of our members meeting with you this morning. It just happened to be that today was the day that we came, and so we had the opportunity to listen to the commissioner introduce the governor's bill. I want to assure you that while we have concerns about some issues, we also are very much committed to having high standards for all of our teacher candidates. And we, I can just give you one little statistic, not coming prepared for that, but when we look at actual admission GPA of our candidates who come about midway through their college career, so they've already been vetted with other kinds of tests and exams and grades, they're sitting there at between a 3.2 and 3.5 GPA on average. And in fact, if we look at a particular major, you'll find that in math, for instance, our people who are doing math ed tend to have higher GPAs than people who are doing straight math content. And they actually take more math content coursework, too. So some of the myths that are out there about who are going into teaching I think as we actually look at the candidates, we see that those aren't really holding up. And I will also tell you that in terms of requiring basic skills tests, our members have mixed feelings about that. There are some institutions who would love to have that there. Mm-hmm. It would make our job easier. But we always go back and say, are we really getting all the candidates who have the potential to really do an outstanding job and reach those kids? And so we sit on the fence on that one. I'll just be very upfront about that. We are concerned very much about those people that we point to and say, we really don't want that person out there in the profession. And that's something that our institutions are working on harder at identifying through our various assessments and really working to either counsel or otherwise exit those students from our programs prior to student teaching. We're not waiting for student teaching anymore.
Thank you. And of course, a number of your institutions are involved in the massive Bush Foundation pilot effort that in large part addresses or attempts to address this issue of being able to do a good matching of quality potential with eventual licensure. Thank you for working with the department. Good to have you here. It's good to see my friend Rose Chu from Metropolitan State Urban Teacher Program, and look forward to continuing working with MACD. Members, Commissioner, House File 3163, I'm trying to think, we don't need to move. Do we need to move this? I don't think we do. We're not going to... Why don't we start the discussion? I'm sorry, Commissioner. I'm just trying to figure out whether I should technically try to move this or not. I know you've got an amendment, and I think in order to do that, we do. But why don't we get you started, and you'll be moving at lightning speed, Commissioner.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Tom and I were talking.
It's quite all right.
What amendment? Was it to this bill?
If you don't have an amendment, that's awesome. So.
Okay, so then, Mr. Chair, I would be honored if you would move the amendment.
All right, why don't we move House File 3163, we recommend it to pass, with a further referral that it be referred to the Finance Committee for K-12 Finance members. I'm going to end up tabling this motion at the end of this hearing. So the Chair makes that motion, and then I will move the A-10-2204 amendment. And so that'll get the bill in the shape that the department wants to have it before us today. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Commissioner, I apologize, but we're going to have to move fast.
We will move fast. Dr. Melcher will do Article 1 for you.
Wonderful.
Mr. Chairman and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. Article 1 is providing a series of technical amendments to the general education area. Section 1 of Article 1 is clarifying that the investment income from the permanent school fund that is transferred to the Department of Education includes the interest earned on the certified monthly earnings. It reflects current MMB practice, and we're trying to maximize the amount of money that gets into the permanent school fund and then out to the district, so that it includes these interest earnings while the money's kind of waiting for transfer, as well as what they earn on their ongoing basis.
And Dr. Melcher, I apologize to you, but I really, really want to go fast through this because this is really Representative Greiling's area.
Okay.
And so I don't think I don't want us to really dig deep into this.
Okay. Section 2 is simply clarifying a cross-reference relating to the OPEB levy. Section 3 is clarifying the definition of general education revenue for purposes of special education excess cost calculations. Section 4 is relating to clarification of language enacted last year on retired employee health benefits that was included in the technical corrections bill but didn't have time to pass. And Section 5 is the one piece in Article 1 that is a policy change, and this would eliminate the a maintenance of effort provision relating to licensed school support services that currently require school districts to maintain the same level of staffing or expenditures for counseling, social work, nursing, psychology, and so forth. So that's the one policy change in here.
Thank you, Dr. Melcher. We will no doubt spend some time talking about that next week.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just briefly speak to the amendment language as well. This is language that would relate to borrowing by school districts and charter schools, and clarifies that line of credit agreements with financial institutions are unsecured lines of credit, and it would further clarify that payments that the Department of Education makes should be going to school districts or charter schools, and should not be assigned directly to a lender that the school district or charter school has borrowed money to.
Very well. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Article 2, the Education Excellence Act, does the clarification for the Gifted and Talented Program. It includes charter schools now as a clarification. And then also clarifies to use tools and methods that are sensitive to underrepresented groups, so that more underrepresented groups are identified for Gifted and Talented Programs. And then Mr. Mattson will talk about some of the testing.
Wonderful, Dr. Mattson.
Mr. Chair, Dirk Mattson with the department. Paragraph A under Section 2, we brought this request to the committee before, or to the legislature before, asking to actually reduce the stress of field testing by being able to count on districts and their participation in field testing. Right now it's an all-call, which really affects the sampling procedures and actually makes us go to districts, go to the well, to continue the analogy, many times, as opposed to reducing that frequency. Paragraph D of Section 2 deals with clarification of language regarding to the graduation test notation, pass, no pass on that, which is expected under the letter to Runkle in special education. Section 3 talks about just make some technical requests regarding the security of the tests, and making sure that no personal identifiable information regarding the test results, calling that non-public. Section 4 continues on with test security, just trying to articulate the that the test items themselves are not public data. We certainly do have provisions for reviewing test items by anyone in the public, but making sure that they are not available for release in the newspaper, etc., and that's the end of the testing elements. I beg your pardon. There is one additional part in Section 4, and that deals with asking to strike language regarding I've missed my spot here. One second, please. I apologize.
I think you're Section 5, I believe.
Yes, yeah, Section 5. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Asking to strike language. The department does not collect information on single-parent families, parent income, etc. We have no ability to make such as have the commissioner acknowledge performance based on those factors, and currently are not doing this task now, and ask for a technical revision of
commissioner,
that.
Commissioner, it's a dagger to my heart, but we have talked about this issue, and so my understanding is that if the data isn't being collected, it's hard for you to get it. But we'll keep trying to figure out a way to do this. So, thank you, Dr. Mattson.
Mr. Chair, then Section 6 is just a clarification, technical change. The old law had a vendor actually in the law that was indicated. We just want to clarify that that it's a subject area content test on lines 1035.
Commissioner, so I always thought Praxis was just, it stood for something other than a vendor.
So no. So it's a company's test that's been used for a long time. So we just want to clarify, we want to be neutral on that. Then on the concurrent enrollment statute, we have an appropriation in place, but we had so much demand that we really cannot pay out what is in law. And so we're just clarifying that it should be prorated. To the extent and push out as much as we can, but it has to be prorated. And then also that we want to make sure that the eligibility or how these programs are established also have some criteria around them that have some standards to be eligible to receive the college and the school's money.
And Commissioner, Section 7 back on lines 11, 22 through 24. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, and that's also some additional language. The college and the career and technical programs also want to make it clear that if there's any technical programs that are eligible for college in the schools, that they are recognized career and technical programs of study that are approved by the commissioner and the MNSCU system, so that we know that there's quality behind those programs also.
Mr. Chair.
Assistant Commissioner.
For the record, my name is Chaz Anderson, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Education. I will go through the charter school changes with David Hartman from the department. The first change, a lot of this is clarification from the 2009 changes.
And give us the section site.
Yes, page 12, line 20 and 21. This is a clarification of the grandfather provision. As you may remember, last session, the legislature decided to grandfather in three non-public secretarian organizations to serve as potential authorizers after June 30th, 2011. This just clarifies that change. Page 13, line 30, this is a technical amendment. Actually, the D should have referred to application for approval and not affidavit. The next change you'll find on page 17. This is clarifying the intent of the changes that were made on the board membership for charter schools. The intent of changes was to make sure that staff were not serving in capacities on boards, and that they were elections of involving parents, and the staff actually could elect parents and then providing what slots would be filled. So the changes are made as such on line 4. We clarify that the teacher that's on the board must be serving as a teacher at the school. The next change is actually a technical change to contract. It said contact. The change on line 7, we want to make sure that the parent or legal guardian of the student enrolled in the charter school is not employed by the charter school, so that it's truly a parent that doesn't have ties to the school. Lines 10, this is a clarification. We have some folks that have our chief financial officers and charter school directors that do not want to serve on the board as ex officio members. This said they shall serve as ex officio members, so we're making this may, so it's optional that they serve as ex officio members. And then we also clarify that charter school employees or contractors shall not serve on the board unless the employee is the licensed teacher under that provision that a licensed teacher can serve on the board.
Very well.
And the next change you will find on page 18, lines 18 through 26. We recently, in the past year, had two charter schools merge into one. The merger was not as smooth as we would have liked it. They merged under Chapter 317A, which is the nonprofit statute. So in the future, what we'd like to propose is that before a charter school merges, that they seek approval from the commissioner and they outline why they are merging, and that surviving charter school will submit a plan that outlines the financial management plan, including the transfer of assets and liabilities, the administration operations plan, the school's governance plan, and the academic achievement plan. The next proposed change on page 18 starts with subdivision section 11, or subdivision 4B. This is a proposal for replicating high-performing charter schools. This is a new provision. It's not a clarification of the changes made last year. What we're proposing here is the commissioner may approve up to 5 charter school models proven to emulate highly effective practices and significantly improve student academic growth and proficiency. An approved authorizer must submit an application to the commissioner to replicate high-performing models. They may replicate up to 5 models and have flexibility on governance of those models. So the big change here is that instead of, if they had replicated up to 5 models, that there would be one single charter school board governing those 5 schools instead of 5 separate boards, as what we'd have to have right now under law. This will also help us with our federal charter school aid, in that we have been trying to use that aid to replicate models, but USDE has told us that because we have this provision in law where we have to have separate boards, they actually have to be separate entities, and they can't be under one approved charter. So what we're saying here is that the commissioner can approve up to 5 models, and within those 5 models, they can have up to 5 charter schools to replicate.
Members, this is new. It's a big concept. I promise, as the author of the bill, next week when we come in, that we'll spend some time, regardless of whether I have it in my amended language or not, but I think it merits a good discussion. So I just want you to pay attention to that. Ms. Anderson.
The next change you'll find on page 20, this involves the annual audits that school districts and charter schools must submit to the department by December 31st of each year. It just clarifies that the professional service entity that's providing the audit to the department has the ability to communicate with the department about the audit. As you know, we've had some charter schools that have some financial difficulties. We want to make sure that we are able to communicate with the entity that's conducting the outside audit. Page 21, lines 10 and 11, this is some changes to the commissioner's ability to terminate a contract between an authorizer and a charter school. Currently, the commissioner can terminate a contract under provisions 1 through 3. She would have to go to a Chapter 14 hearing in front of an administrative law judge before termination. That's a little bit higher standard than an authorizer would have. But what we're proposing here is that under the pupil performance requirements, we change it from contained in the contract to consistent with state law. The concern is that each contract may have a different standard for pupil performance requirements. We want to make sure the standard is consistent from contract to contract. We also delete repeated or major violations of the law and change that to violations of the law to be consistent with the termination standard between an authorizer and a charter school. The next change you'll find is on page 22. This is lines 9 and 10. We have two statutes that govern for school districts and charter schools the reduction or withholding of state aid. That's 127A.42 and 127A.43. If what we're clarifying is that the formula used to withhold or reduce state aid for teacher licensure violations is actually the formula outlined in 127A.43. Also in that statute, we make a change from withheld to reduce to make that consistent with 127A.42 and also consistent with the charter school statute 124D10 subdivision 8.
Thank you, Commissioner Anderson. And members, those particular provisions have been the source of some controversy of late, and so we'll have an opportunity to discuss those as well. Members, I am told by the department they only need 5 more minutes. I will not hold members here. Obviously I can't anyway. I can lock the doors. I get the pages to do that. So if members need to scoop, please scoop. But I do want to get through the rest of the presentation of the department. If you can hang in there for that, that'd be terrific. Morning.
Good morning. I'm Barbara Trilline, Director of Special Ed Policy at the department, and I'm going to be covering Section 1 of Article 3, Special Programs. The first section has to do with clarification of language. There's a lot of terms used in special education, and when federal and state don't align and reauthorize at the same time, we have to play catch-up.
And these terms are very, very important.
They are very important. So we've been very carefully trying to align them the best we can to share with RUL, and two of them are going to be in the new reauthorization for IDEA. So this is about alignment.
Good morning. I'm Robin Whitley. I work at the Department of Education, too, in Special Education Policy. And if you look at Section 2, that relates to some changes that we needed to make to clarify language within the third-party payment section. And basically, it lets districts know some different ways in which they can use their revenue. If you move to Section 3 and Section 4, that is both language that's needed in a technical format that aligns the federal regulations in the right way. So we just updated some of the numbers with the federal regs for special education.
Sure.
And Section 5 is some language that seeks to clarify the relationship with the Minnesota Resource Centers, which are centers that provide services to kids that are deaf, hard of hearing, and visually impaired. And we wanted to make sure that that relationship was clarified to show that that resource center is a part of the Minnesota Department of Education, and also that we would be providing some other kind of educational strategies to staff that are requesting it along with parents, other than just summer institutes and conferences, because that was a request that was made by staff. And Section 6 is another piece that goes along with the Minnesota Resource Center. And what it does is aligns language that is in current law to subdivision, a piece of law that aligns to what we do with children with hearing impairments ages birth to 3 in terms of their state performance plan reporting requirements, and we want to make sure that we're aligning and reporting those same kind of measures for children with hearing impairments ages 3 to 21.
Two more sections. Barbara Trilene again. Section 7 is using the term individualized education program, which is the official language in IDEA, and we have a number of variations in that throughout the statute. So this is a cleanup to match the Code of Federal Regulations. And the last one is Section 8. It's a repealer of the Interagency Office on Transition Services. We consider it redundant because we've had grants, interagency agreements with a couple of agencies, and our federal requirement through our state performance plan that's required by the U.S. Department of Ed includes data collection on transition services. So our work is cut out for us through other mandates, and so this is just eliminating something that's redundant.
And members, you'll find the language for the office on 1R attached to the bill.
Mr. Chair, the following sections, Article 4 is early childhood, and I think that is to be heard in Representative Slawick's.
That would be appropriate.
And Mr. Chair, that is all.
The department was true to its word, I think less than 5 minutes. So members, the chair, the author, well, the chair will lay over House File 3163. Members, it's going to be a busy week next week. We will not be meeting this evening. We most likely will have at least one evening meeting next week in order to get bills through to meet our first committee deadline. We're also going to be hearing from the CCRPI assessment proposal. We'll have a bill with that. We'll also have a bill on multi-tier licensing from Representative Depke. Representative Newton's going to have his integration revenue recommendation bill. And then we'll be doing shaping up the policy article bill in which a number of provisions that we've heard in the past will also, it is the chair's intent to put some of those in play as amendments to this bill. So get plenty of rest over the weekend. We'll be working hard next week. Thank you all for being here and being diligent, and this committee stands adjourned.